All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Mary J. Schoen presiding. All those who have business before the court, draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Morning. My name is Judge Schoen. To my right is Judge Allen. To my left is Judge Toke. We're here today to hear the case of Stenson Fears Jr. versus Robert L. Wilkie, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 17-2345. Would counsel for each party please note your appearance for the record?
James Heiberg on behalf of the Secretary.
Dustin Elias on behalf of the Secretary.
Brian Lewis, Francis Boyle Law PLLC, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Stenson Fears Jr.
Thank you. Does appellant's counsel wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. 6 minutes, please.
You may begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Judge Schoen, may it please the court. The root cause of why we are here today is that a legal argument had failed to be raised at the Board of Veterans Appeals by a properly certified veteran service officer. In other words, a layperson. Had the legal argument of offensive collateral estoppel been raised before the board, it would have been preserved. However, because of the nature of offensive collateral estoppel and the nature of laypersons representing other laypersons before the board, combined with the historically paternalistic nature of the veterans claim system, such a legal issue can be raised in the first instance before this court.
What's your, you made that point in your reply brief as well. What's your authority for that statement, especially in the context of the question of the competency of an examiner, given cases like Parks and Rizzo and Bastian from the Federal Circuit?
Judge Allen, to answer the first part of that question, the authority there would be that the Federal Circuit has expressly declared that the Federal Circuit, and by direction this court, should be less stringent in requiring that the issue has been raised explicitly below than in the usual case, and that comes from Forche v. Principi. This court itself has held that it has discretion to address issues not raised below in the first instance, and has so held in the case of Maggot v. West. If I could ask Judge Allen to restate the second part of that question, I'm sorry.
Well, so the Federal Circuit has been pretty clear that in the context of the issue involving the competency of the, at least the competency of the process for appointment of a VA medical examiner, that regardless of the status of pro se or not, the issue has to be raised before the agency. And the only exception that we've got out there on the books is our decision in Wise. And so it seems to me, just tell you where I'm coming from.
Yes, sir.
That in order for us to get to even the point at which your collateral estoppel argument would be relevant, you have to get through what I'm going to call it the Wise gateway.
Okay.
Meaning the gateway that says that your client's failure to raise this before the board isn't fatal to our consideration of the issue. Right? So that's, I think, for me, the important starting point to get to your argument.
Yes, Your Honor. And the Wise gateway applies where an examiner has raised the issue of their own competence. In the issue here where there's offensive collateral estoppel, the examiner raises that statement by merely signing the opinion, because the government has litigated the issue of the examiner's competence in a collateral in a court about 3/4 of a mile away from this very courthouse to a conclusion favorable to it.
I'm sorry. Can I clarify what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
You're saying by his very signature, are you saying that it's Wilhelm or that it's CMP examiner?
By the signature of Dr. Gary Wilhelm on the exam, he has placed his credentials in contention. While in Wise, the issue was whether, I believe it was a cardiologist, said that they were so unfamiliar with psychological concepts.
I'm sorry to jump in. How would that turn Wise into the rule and not the exception? Because every time an examiner signed a report, he or she would be putting their credentials in question, right? And so then the Federal Circuit would have said, you generally have to raise this. We have a narrow exception in Wise that, if we adopted your view, would actually negate the Federal Circuit's rule, which I don't think we can do, and I don't think they'd want us to do in any event. So in other words, let me say it this way. One can't bootstrap your way into saying the credentials are the thing that are put into contesting by signing it, because you know that there is this other issue, right? Because there's got to be something else here that allows you to avoid the consequences of not raising it.
Your Honor, the position is that because he has signed it and he has a judgment out there that was decided by an Article III court, that the government has litigated to its favorable conclusion, that he has placed it by signing. I don't believe that the exception is as big as you posit in the example. I believe that I would hope to believe that there are very few examiners at the VA who have this type of problem, where they have litigated an issue regarding their own competency and lost.
Well, how would the VA or the board in particular know about the litigation that Dr. Wilhelm participated in years before, when he was employee or member of the armed forces?
Judge Holman, I think that first off, it's a reported opinion. It's listed in the federal supplement, and that is one way. Disclosure on the employment application for VA would be another way. And also, if they have that knowledge as part of the employment process, then failing to notify appellant along the way that there is this judgment would also be a violation of the duty to assist.
That's a different argument than you made in your briefs.
No, Your Honor. The argument is that it's out there and it's accessible. So if it's not raised by VA and we raise it, regardless of where we raise it, because collateral estoppel is jurisdictional in nature, it can be raised at any time. And depending on how it would be raised, whether it's by the VA or by us, it would be determinative of the outcome and possibly the duty to assist.
Why do you say it's jurisdictional?
Your Honor, Judge Allen, with collateral estoppel, once the issue is decided, unless there are special factors counseling hesitation, as the Court of International Trade outlined in Gulfstream Aerospace Corporation, then that issue of Dr. Wilhelm's competence should be taken for granted and assumed to be incompetent, and it should be binding on the Board of Veterans' Appeal in this court.
It strikes me there's two difficulties with that collateral estoppel argument. One is, I think the doctrine generally requires privity. So, I mean, the exact same parties and something resembling the exact same posture of whatever the earlier litigation was. And second, it can't be used against the government. The government's a party here.
Judge Toth, the first part of that is that the parties do not have to be in privity for offensive collateral estoppel to apply, as the Supreme Court recognized in Park Lane Hosiery. The second part of that is that while the Supreme Court has said that offensive collateral estoppel cannot apply, the opinion restricted its use to the circumstances expressly decided in Mendoza, which is the Supreme Court case that Your Honor is referencing. Some of the lower courts have pointed out, the non-mutual collateral estoppel would not apply against the government as to issues such as those involved in that case. Such a qualification was intended is clear from the fact that it appears throughout the opinion that the words "the issues involved in that case," which was decided under the Immigration and Naturalization Act. The court did not simply posit that the government was in a unique position in any litigation and base its point on that alone, and that comes from Colorado Springs Produce Credit Association out of Colorado.
I mean, it strikes me as a bit of a heavy lift here. Even if we assumed all of that were true, in the sense of everything, that collateral dot, the estoppel could be invoked here, it's not altogether clear what that district court judgment, what fact it would purport, other than what the Army met its administrative burden in making that finding. I don't think the court said, as a matter of law, that he's deemed incompetent as a practitioner in a certain field.
Judge, so the district court held in Wilhelm v. Caldera that that Dr. Wilhelm had been discharged from the Army for failing to possess a critical skill, that being competency in the operating room and inpatient care.
No, that's actually not.
Okay.
That's not what the court held was that the Army
had met
was not arbitrary and capricious in determining that it believed that he was not professionally competent in that area. Those are two very different questions, right? So if I decide a question, right, this person is a good advocate. But if what I'm saying is I'm deciding whether Judge Scholin's determination about whether they were a good advocate is arbitrary and capricious.
A very deferential standard.
A very deferential standard, right? So it's actually not the same. It's not the same issue that is before the board that was before the district court across the street.
And Judge Allen, that the Army made the finding and was affirmed, even under the arbitrary and capricious standard, and given the unique deference that's afforded to military decisions, is highly probative to the fact of the examiner's competence, and should be permitted to be raised here and or in the board below, simply because of the paternalistic nature of these proceedings, where a licensed attorney may not be available to assist the veteran before this stage of the proceeding.
Let's assume that we would agree. I find this particular case that you're pointing to confusing in how to apply collateral estoppel here, in that Wilhelm was one party, the military was another party, and now you're asserting against the VA. So even if we were to assume that the government is the government won in Wilhelm v. Caldera. So how do we apply offensive estoppel against the government when they won in this situation?
Judge Scholin, I think the answer comes from the court of, I think the answer to that comes from the Court of International Trade. And they laid out a three-factor test in determining whether offensive collateral estoppel could apply against the government, and then what the consequences of that decision would be. The first factor would be whether the issue had an opportunity to develop or percolate among the circuit courts. Here, this is the only court, essentially, with jurisdiction to determine veterans' issues and claims for veterans' benefits. Whether the government's ability and discretion to seek review of unfavorable judgments would be compromised. Here, as Your Honor correctly pointed out, the government litigated the issue of Dr. Wilhelm's competence to its favorable conclusion. So it did receive the benefit of that litigation, and the district court properly upheld the termination of Dr. Wilhelm from the Army. And three, whether policy changes in the executive administration have been accounted for. Here, the policy determination of examiner competence is not really a policy determination at all. It's an issue of fact.
Okay.
But
go ahead.
But you don't. At some level, you know, having once been a law professor and taught collateral estoppel, it's always fun for me to talk about it. But at some level, it's totally irrelevant. And what I mean by that is, you don't need to stop the government to win in theory. If the nature of this other litigation is such that it comes within the existence of the litigation comes within the Wise exception, then your client wins, in a sense, because the board would have been then required to discuss competency, just like it would have in Wise. And it didn't, and so we send you back. So I'm back to the question I started with, which is, what is it about the existence of the litigation, right, the mere existence, that would be similar to the examiner saying, as she did in Wise, I have no expertise at all to do this?
Your Honor, I think that part of that is the fact that Dr. Wilhelm, by being hired by the VA, had a basis for being questionable at best, and certainly should have been discussed as a matter of examiner competency.
Well, but how would they know that? I mean, so are you essentially charging the veterans law judge with all the knowledge of the institution that is the VA? Because the argument would be, he applied to the VA, he would have disclosed the issue with the Army, so the VA writ large was put on notice about this, and therefore that knowledge then is imputed to the veterans law judge, who then would then be deemed to then have to discuss that?
Judge Allen, I think that you're correct in that the knowledge of Examiner Wilhelm's qualifications or lack thereof is imputed to the agency as a whole, and I think that the correct answer would be that when the agency hires a professional examiner whose competency has been called into question previously, that it would either implicate the duty to care or the duty to assist, or a or certainly if it's raised at this court, that and with the appropriate citation paperwork, etc., that it would be a remand to discuss that issue, and I think that would be the position of the court. And in the record before the agency itself, we find further evidence of Dr. Wilhelm's lack of competence, especially discussing the condition that applies to the veteran, where he cites a study from 1987, and however misstates that study and misstates the conclusion.
That doesn't go to, at least not under existing law, that doesn't go to his competence to render an examination. That may go to the adequacy of the examination itself, perhaps.
It would go to his ability to render an opinion under 38 CFR 3.159A.
That would be just a gigantic revolution in the law, because I haven't quizzed my colleagues up here, but I'd be willing to bet that each of us just this week has found a VA medical exam to be inadequate. But I don't think any of us thought that we were finding the VA medical examiner to be incompetent to render an opinion.
Your Honor, I could agree if it was a misstatement of a word, something not dropped in the wrong place, or some other type of Scrivener's error. However, when taken in combination with the previous determination of, or the previous question of examiner competency, it lends more credence to the fact that the examiner has indeed been incompetent, and does, and the remand is in order to discuss, for the VA to establish the competency of the examiner.
Speaking of other evidence, you know, you point to this district court decision, articles that were written. Now, none of these things are in the record for the agency. The board, they're not for the board.
Your Honor, let me come in here. I find it on, I find the reference to the study, I have it on page 381 of the RBA.
The study,
the reference to the study. It's in...
But what study are you specifically speaking of?
The one we were, the 1987 study that is in the reference.
I think Judge Sherwin's asking you to.
That's why I'm confused.
Okay, I'm sorry.
You're answering part of this question. I'm speaking specifically of the articles regarding the TBI.
There's referenced in your brief that there are another article.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Because yes. It was the TBI issues. I think I've connected you
Thank
with
you.
Your show then now. I'm not
so
sure.
The three of us together can answer and ask one question.
Three of us for one question, Your Honor.
Exactly. So you have these things that were not in the veterans claims file. They were not in the record before the agency.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So how do we overcome a case like Kine, which I'm very familiar with, in which I was reversed by the Federal Circuit, and was told that we can't look at evidence outside of the claims file?
Your Honor, I believe that Kine speaks to evidence that is outside of the claims file, and not it also speaks to, if I remember correctly, adjudicative facts. And if I recall Kine correctly, that was a proposition under kind of similar to Rule 201, where the court took notice of affidavits. That in this case, it is a fact of common knowledge, easily determinable, that the Minneapolis VA, under the direction of Dr. Wilhelm, had these problems, and it speaks to the same continuing sorts of issues.
Does Kine seem to allow any room for exception based on something that's outside the record?
Yes, Your Honor, and to the extent that the court was taking notice of facts that of adjudicative facts in the form of affidavits, it is distinguishable from the case here, where these issues occurred, were determined, I believe, by the VAOIG to have happened at Minneapolis, and these are not the same sort of case-specific facts that were at issue in Kine.
Well, one could argue whether Dr. Wilhelm's ability to supervise others performing exams is relevant to the question of his own competency to perform an exam. So there's still an adjudicative action necessary to make that connection.
Your Honor, I would say that as a matter of public knowledge, as a matter of not case specific fact, it would seem to be in a posit to Kine, where Kine delved into that, and the articles that were referenced regarding his ability to supervise would be the type of knowledge that Rule of Evidence 201 would seem to call for.
Right, but do the rules of evidence apply to this court or the board?
The rules of evidence are loosely applied to the board. The rules of evidence here are somewhat, are mostly applicable, And I believe that Rule 201, at least as it is distinguishable from the facts in kind, could be held to apply in this case.
Do district courts where the federal rules of evidence apply have the limitation that they are bound by the record below the agency, that we are bound by our statute and by kind?
The federal district courts, there is some split between what is in administrative agency action where the record locks. There are some exceptions at the district court level where the record can be opened to permit introduction of evidence that wasn't presented below. The one case that seems to come to mind is the Federal Circuit opinion in an Axiom Resource.
And do any of those exceptions apply to this court?
Your Honor, what I would suggest is that since it hasn't been briefed below, that if the court is interested in that, that the parties be ordered into supplemental briefing on that.
Just one question.
Don, can you please add 2 minutes?
Which is, again, in theory, you don't have to win sort of the argument, if you will, about whether or not we could consider these articles necessarily as part of our decision, right? I mean, isn't it, your fundamental position is, again, I'm going back to my wise gateway, right?
Yes.
There has to be something in the world that puts the board on notice that it has to talk about competency. As far as Wise is concerned, on its facts, it's talking about something in the exam itself. In theory, that exception doesn't have to be limited to just in the exam itself. It could be a fact of great notoriety. I mean, hypothetically, if during the course of the board's consideration of a case, it is on the news like O.J. Simpson, that the person who rendered the exam has been subject to some horrible lawsuit in which, you know, they are randomly or they are rampantly incompetent, right? So I mean, at some level, I'm just suggesting that maybe you don't have to establish that we could look at it for an adjudicative purpose other than to say the board should have been aware of this. Right? Just that's a thought.
And Judge Allen, unlike OJ, I do believe that Dr. Wilhelm's gloves do fit. But obviously, as an advocate, we would like to win the entire field. But if the court decides that a narrower interpretation where the examiner has these types of problems, then we end up in your situation where they've called themselves into question. And certainly, with on the final few seconds, with the layperson assisting below that's not qualified to read a legal argument, certainly here where it's raised and licensed attorneys are talking about this type of issue, then we end up at that Wise gateway where there is this issue that should probably be remanded to the agency for that. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is James Heiberg, and I represent the Secretary. The court should affirm the board's April 6, 2017 decision because a claimant must expressly raise the issue of the examiner's competence before the board in all circumstances to rebut the presumption of competency that VA has chosen a qualified examiner.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt your flow. Could you pull the microphone slightly closer to you?
Certainly, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Better?
Yes.
Okay.
I want to actually hear what you're saying.
Certainly, this doctrine is established through the Rizzo line of cases, and Rizzo holds that where a veteran does not challenge a VA medical expert's competence or qualifications before the board, VA need not affirmatively establish that expert's competency. And certainly the Bastion, Sickles, and Parks cases that followed also emphasized that the objection must be made to rebut the presumption. The first step to overcome the presumption, even if the veteran is pro se, and presumably this would extend to a representative before the board, is that the objection must be made, otherwise it is waived. And that is from Parks.
So I'm I think I'm on board with you about that, right? And so definitely the Federal Circuit has been pretty clear in that line of cases. So as I was suggesting in the appellant's argument, for me, this comes down to the breadth of the possible Wise exception to that rule. Because Wise was an exception, because there was no objection in Wise. And the court said, under the facts of that case, the court was able to look past the fact that there was no objection, right?
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. Correct.
So what is your understanding of the potential breadth of the exception that we recognize in Wise?
Well, certainly in Wise, you had an examiner calling into question her own competence, which is not present in this case. I think Wise can be distinguished in the sense that what creates the appearance of irregularity. Everything that appellant has argued relates to extra record evidence, but assuming that were known to the board, if it were known to the board, you have the Wilhelm versus Caldera case where the issue of Dr. Wilhelm's competence was never determined. It was simply an issue of whether or not his due process rights had been violated. And that decision references that he was actually transferred to become the head of, I think, a general outpatient clinic at Fort Leavenworth. So there's certainly no issue as to his competence as a doctor. At worst, it would indicate that he was not fit to perform as an orthopedic surgeon.
So two follow-ups to that. First, I assume that you agree that had Mr. Fears given a copy of the decision in Wilhelm to the veterans law judge, that he or she would have had an obligation at that point to consider whether it had an impact on the presumption of regularity in terms of the competence.
Yes, Your Honor, you'd have a situation there where you had an express challenge to the examiner's qualifications that would require the board to provide the analysis of competence.
And second, I think I heard you correctly, and if I did, I agree with you, I'll tell you, Seth, is that Wise, the examiner saying something that almost sounds like a law school hypothetical, right, which is, I'm giving you my opinion, but I'm also telling you simultaneously I'm incompetent, right, doesn't, by its nature, set the outer boundaries of something that can be so apparent that it makes the regularity presumption something the board would have to discuss on its own. In other words, something else could be like that.
Perhaps, Your Honor. I mean, certainly, as you say, it's certainly a law school hypothetical where you do have somebody who says, I'm not competent to do this. And is it limited to just a situation like that? Probably not. But I guess the fundamental question is whether or not the choice creates an appearance of irregularity. And again, with regards to Dr. Wilhelm's lawsuit against the Secretary of the Army, there's no indication there that it questions his competency. He's still a physician, and there's nothing that would indicate he would not be competent to perform an examination to determine the etiology of hepatitis. Same also with these news articles regarding Minnesota, where, again, assuming for the purposes of the argument that they're factual, it might reflect on the doctor's managerial capabilities, but again, has no bearing that would raise the issue of creating an appearance of irregularity in terms of his assignment to perform the medical examination.
Are you conceding that the knowledge of the district court case was imputed to the board member?
No, Your Honor. I don't think there's any reason why the board would have really had any reason to know about this prior decision from Wilhelm versus Caldera. And again, even if it did, it is so tenuous a connection for competence that I don't believe that any issue regarding Wise is raised by it.
No, but you really have to win on the first point, right? Because if we assume that it was somehow constructively before the board, then the board erred by not talking about it, right? And so really, it seems to me, because you had said if Mr. Fears had actually walked up to the BLJ and handed him or her the decision, that would have imposed an obligation on the BLJ to say why that didn't raise the issue of a problem, right? So if in fact, as to the first part of Judge Shulman's, or the, to Judge Shulman's question, if in fact it was before the board, then the board would have had to talk about it, whether it was actually before the board or constructively, right?
Well, in terms of being constructively before the board, I think that it's a situation that really would be so kind of buried into the reporters that it would be very difficult to expect the board to have been aware of this, certainly for the purposes at issue, the comments before this examination. Obviously, if there had been any kind of finding that had stripped him of his medical license or something like that, it might have been more apparent. But the facts of Wilhelm versus Caldera are, again, so remote as to the actual issue of competence that I don't believe that Wise is raised.
I'd like to build on the hypothetical that Judge Allen mentioned, sort of the OJ scenario. Like, let us assume there was a doctor out there killing patients, had never gone to medical school, whatever parade of horribles you could think of, and it was all over the news. And that doctor had conducted a compensation exam for a veteran. Would that general notoriety be imputed to a board member?
In terms of an outer news issue, perhaps, but in, at least in terms of whether it was regarding documents that were belonging to the agency that might have discussed this, that would be a slightly different matter. In terms of what the board might deal
with. So something that is outside of the claims file or the RVA, but is of such notoriety, could still satisfy creating this assertion or appearance of raising the issue of competence in the outside world?
Perhaps, Your Honor, I think it would be more applicable if it were certainly internal documents that might reflect that rather than general news in the outside world. That in and of itself, though, could conceivably raise an issue of the appearance of irregularity that could be covered under WISE. Certainly, however, in this...
Could I just ask you that, when you said it would be more, you didn't use the word more powerful, but something like that, with internal documents, so what did you mean by that? Because I would have thought that your position would be that an individual veterans law judge is not charged with knowledge of everything that's internal to the agency that isn't before the adjudicator in a given case, but you just seem to suggest that it would be more powerful if there were some internal document at the VA than if, in Judge Shulman's hypothetical, everything was in the news about a doctor going around killing patients, right?
Well, it could be conceivably a Bell situation where if you had some sort of internal document that would be within the realm of VA's constructive possession of knowledge. But at least in terms of the issue here, there again, as alleged, whatever happened at the Minnesota VAMC with regards to Dr. Wilhelm, again, was, I'm not even sure the facts really established that with the documentation, extra record documentation that had been provided by appellant's pleadings, but...
Can we even look at it?
No, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I think it's prohibited.
So us determining whether it's relevant or whatever is a step down from what we could even do.
Your Honor, we believe that the court is limited by what is contained in the record, and there's certainly nothing facially in the record that would indicate a WISE problem.
I think it's Rizzo and one of the cases following on Rizzo that said that generally what happens is a representative or a veteran just requests a CV of the examiner, and then VA under the duty to assist discloses that, and that's the way that these competency challenges would normally arise before the board. So WISE provides sort of a different approach where the examiner has to respond and puts it into the record. Are there other means that sort of happen at the board where people can challenge the competency of an examiner, or just other things that would a veteran could request that VA would have a duty to assist and provide in terms of answering questions about the qualifications of the examiner?
Yes, sir. I mean, they can, if the request that they, under NOR, they're going to have to be provided as part of the duty to assist. And that in and of itself would not constitute a challenge to the competence, but it could, you know, it's the essential cornerstone for any potential following objection to the competence of the examiner, which would then, of course, require the board to address the issue. As fact finder, they are the appropriate body to do so.
So we don't have to mark then the outer boundaries necessarily of what could come within WISE necessarily in this case, if we concluded that, hypothetically, that the appellant's arguments don't come within WISE, no matter how broadly one construes it, we could simply say that WISE is an example of when something on the face of a report, for example, flags the issue for the board. It's not an exhaustive example. Other things can come there, but it's just that this doesn't. I mean, would that be?
Yes, Your Honor, I think that's a fair assessment, because we're in WISE, you do have a certain situation where the examiner questioned her own competence, but obviously not limited to that specifically. It really goes towards the issue of what creates the appearance of irregularity.
So hypothetically, I mean, and I'm not saying this would necessarily qualify, but you know, if a veteran had a condition of colon cancer and the CMP exam was rendered by a pediatric dentist, arguably something like that, when the specialty is so far removed from the particular condition, something like that could perhaps fall in the appropriate case within something that would say, that would make a board say, let's just see if the dentist is okay.
Well, at least in terms of that particular issue, I think Parks addressed that with regards to a nurse practitioner with a family medicine background performing an examination regarding the cause of diabetes. There was no objection raised there, so it was waived. But WISE, in discussing Parks, indicated there was no evidence in the record creating an appearance of irregularity. So even when you have someone who is in a facially different field of medicine, that in and of itself would not create any WISE exception.
But we wouldn't have to go that far, because both Parks and WISE are different from my pediatric dentist example, right? Because if you are in a family practice as a nurse practitioner or a doctor, you are seeing the range of things that would include people who come in not even knowing they have diabetes, let alone people who come in and they have it. And in WISE, well, the cardiologist wasn't, and clearly said, I'm no expert on psychiatric conditions. It was the issue in the case was a connection between heart and PTSD, right?
Yes, sir.
So hypothetically, at least, there could be a situation where the specialty is so far removed from the particular condition that it would raise an obligation for the board to think about it. The podiatrist and brain cancer, for example, right? I mean, we don't have to mark that out, but I'm telling you, I don't think the other cases establish that can never establish a significant obligation on the board to talk about something.
Well, Your Honor, certainly specialist examinations are provided for hearing, vision, dental, and psychiatric matters. And that, if that is not followed, that certainly raises Stigall issues if someone is not properly assigned. Here, of course, we don't believe there's any Stigall issue at all, because the remand order in May 2014 requested an appropriate examiner, preferably a hepatologist, but did not specifically order. But at least in terms of the existing law, as long as someone has the appropriate education, training, and experience to offer a medical diagnosis under 38 CFR 3.159A1, they're going to be deemed competent to provide the examination. There's nothing now in existing law that would indicate that somebody with a different specialty like that would necessarily raise a WISE question for a determination of competence.
I don't know if this is perhaps for my own curiosity, but I know there's been a bunch of cases where we've discuss whether the whether a challenge was made at the board to the presumption or whether the presumption was rebutted, there would be never, no court in other rest of the federal circuits ever sort of gone in to look at substantively what would render someone competent or incompetent.
Off the top of my head, I'm not familiar with any determination where the board has found somebody specifically incompetent. There have been times, I believe, when they will look at the credentials and realize it may not match the examination that was required and determine a new examination needs to be required. But off the top of my head,
this is how you would examine the competency question purely in and of itself.
I'm sorry again?
We've never laid down case law with the Federal Circuit saying this is how you would, these are the steps that you would use to kind of examine competency.
No, Your Honor, I believe the case law has simply been addressing the issue of when the challenge to the competence of the examiner must be made. In conclusion, for the reasons I've stated, the court should affirm the board's decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honor, to address a few things that were raised, I did note that there was a question about what is within, if there are some cases where the knowledge is out there regarding practitioner problems. The Government Accounting Office recently sent out a report in February discussing that the VHA needs a greater focus on credentialing to prevent disqualified providers from delivering patient care. Now, in that case, the VHA was talking about adverse actions in the National Practitioner Database, but indeed the parallel can be drawn to an action where a district court or a specialized court, for instance, the Court of Federal Claims, may make a determination as to what happens when a practitioner is released from the Army for failing to possess a critical skill, such as not having the ability to provide to provide care, such as here. The second issue that was raised was that of the Stigall issue, where the remand was sought to have the exam done by a VA examiner, preferably a hepatologist, and that goes to Judge Allen's hypothetical regarding the examiner whose field of practice is so far removed. Here, when the board expressed its preference for a hepatologist exam, it did indeed express its preference, even though it didn't incant such magic words as what is required in the M21-1 that the BVA remand specifies that it must be conducted by a board for certified specialist in whatever, or a specialist who is board qualified in whatever.
But you didn't, at my reading of your briefing in this matter, is that, well, you raised a substantial compliance question. The only issue on which you raised concerning compliance was the what I consider to be the Scrivener's error with respect to the name Marks. At best, I think your reference to the fact that the board said preferably a hepatologist was simply a recitation of what the remand order said.
Your Honor, if I recall correctly, I want to say that was addressed in our I know it was addressed in briefing, and I am drawing a blank right now.
But at
the point here is that since the BVA did not incant the magic words that are required, the agency sent this case to someone who was not a hepatologist, despite the board asking for somebody who was preferably a hepatologist. And various courts, including the Supreme Court, have found that no either legislative or an adjudicative body need and can't those magic words to ensure that action is taken on what they're saying. So if the board wants a hepatologist and expresses a preference for a hepatologist, regardless of the words they use, if it's in there, the board has the duty to the regional office or the agency of original jurisdiction has the obligation to comply with that and do it.
If I could ask an unrelated question that we haven't touched on, but I'd like to before you leave. With regard to the memorandum of unavailability of his records,
yes, sir.
You made an argument that it showed a lack of due diligence, but can you expound on how he would have been prejudiced by this error when it points to his name, Social Security number, and at one point, apparently, Richard Marks held his power of attorney?
Your Honor, what was argued in the briefing was that it wasn't Richard Marks who held his attorney. Richard Marks was a previous national president of DAV or someone in that line from far back. And the prejudicial error in there is evident from the examiner's recitation in his opinion that they weren't able to review those records, such records didn't exist. And that is the prejudicial error, that had those records been available, had they had the proper names or whatever, that would have been found and that could have been associated.
So you're asserting that they potentially searched Richard Marks's records as opposed to this veteran?
Yes, Your Honor. Although, to be fair, it's a suggestion, and the proper agency to opine on that is the board. And for all the reasons that we've explained both here and in the briefing, we'd ask the court to remand to the agency for a decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to take a moment before we adjourn. Today was my last argument as a senior judge of a panel. So I'd like to take the opportunity to thank all the attorneys who've appeared before me over the years, my clerks and staff and the court staff. It's been a privilege and an honor. And the case is now submitted for decision. The court is now adjourned. We'll come down and greet counsel.
All rise.